The Anki Droid story is a slow-burn platform policy dispute that the HN community flagged with 150 points and 13 comments, modest by the day's standards but significant for what it represents. Anki Droid is the Android client for Anki, the spaced repetition flashcard system that has a deeply loyal user base among medical students, language learners, and anyone doing serious long-term memorization work. It's a genuinely open-source project maintained by volunteers, and like many such projects, it relies on donation platforms to sustain development. Open Collective is one of those platforms, a fiscal host that handles tax compliance and financial infrastructure for open source projects.
Google Play's new policy is apparently treating direct donation links within apps as a payments bypass, the argument being that any in-app financial transaction should route through Google Play's billing infrastructure, which means Google takes a cut. Open Collective links don't generate a per-transaction revenue share for Google, so they're being flagged as policy violations. The Anki Droid maintainers are documenting this in a GitHub issue, which is now public and attracting attention from the broader open-source community.
The structural issue here is one the open-source ecosystem has been navigating for years. Platform distribution creates dependency, and platform dependency creates leverage. Google Play reaches essentially every Android user in markets where the Play Store is available. Being removed from or restricted by the Play Store is an existential threat to an app's reach, even if the app itself is perfectly legal and serves a clear public benefit. The maintainers of Anki Droid have no real negotiating power relative to Google. They can comply, fight publicly, or distribute outside the Play Store.
This is actually a good moment to talk about something that comes up every time one of these platform versus open source stories lands on HN, which is the antitrust dimension. Marcus, do you want to walk through some of the legal framework here? Because I think a lot of people hear monopoly and think purely about market share, but the legal standard is quite different.
Happy to, because it's one of those concepts that gets used loosely enough that it actually obscures what's happening. Antitrust law in the United States primarily flows from the Sherman Act of 1890, which has two main operative sections. Section 1 prohibits agreements that restrain trade, that's your price fixing, your market division arrangements between competitors. Section 2 is the one relevant here. It prohibits monopolization, which means willfully acquiring or maintaining monopoly power through exclusionary conduct rather than through competitive merit.
And the key word there is exclusionary. Can you unpack that?
Sure, the courts have spent a century on this. Having a monopoly is not itself illegal. If you build the best product and everyone buys it, you've earned your dominant position through competition on the merits. What's illegal is using that dominant position to foreclose competition through means that wouldn't make business sense except for their exclusionary effect. The classic example is predatory pricing, selling below cost specifically to drive out a competitor, then raising prices afterward. The conduct only makes sense if you're trying to eliminate competition, not if you're trying to serve customers.
So in the Google Play case, what would the antitrust theory look like?
The argument would be that Google has monopoly power in the Android app distribution market, which, given that Play Store is pre-installed and the only way to reach most Android users without sideloading, is probably true in a factual sense. The question is whether restricting open collective donation links constitutes exclusionary conduct. The counterargument from Google's side would be that this is a legitimate payments policy applied consistently across all apps, not targeted specifically at open source projects or at competitors. The problem with that defense is that legitimate business justification can be a fig leaf. Courts look at the actual competitive effect, not just the stated rationale. But market share alone, even 90%, doesn't make a company guilty of monopolization. You need the exclusionary conduct plus the power to sustain it.
Which explains why so many antitrust cases drag on for years. You have to prove both the power and the conduct. And the conduct has to be the kind that harms competition rather than just harming individual competitors.
Right, and for Anki Droid specifically, the most plausible near-term outcome is probably that Google adjusts the policy after enough public pressure, the way they've done with other developer relations disputes. The legal route is available but expensive and slow, and small open-source projects don't have the resources to pursue it.
Fastpotify at Fastpotify. Rox is essentially a speed-optimized Spotify interface. The core complaint it's addressing is that the official Spotify application has become progressively heavier and slower over time, and Fastpotify strips it back to a fast, functional client focused on playing music without the overhead of the social features, podcast discovery, and algorithmic. The FastPotify story is a fascinating contrast, a community-built tool that topped the HN front page with 469 points and 251 comments. Recommendation layers.
The HN thread is one of the more energetic debates I've seen on application bloat. One camp argues that Spotify's increasing complexity is a deliberate product decision that serves Spotify's business interests. They want you discovering podcasts and playlists because that drives engagement metrics and advertising revenue, not because it makes the music playback experience better. The other camp argues that the bloat is just the inevitable accumulation of features across a large organization where nobody has the authority to delete anything.
Both are probably true simultaneously, which is the frustrating thing. The FastPotify project itself is technically interesting. It's using Spotify's existing API access rather than reverse engineering the client, which keeps it on the right side of terms of service, at least for now. The comments include several people noting that fast, minimal wrappers around major platform APIs have a historically short lifespan because the platforms eventually tighten API access or add rate limits, specifically because they don't want third-party clients that compete with the experience they are optimizing for.
Doltlight is the database story that the infrastructure community is paying closest attention to today, 52 points and 36 comments, with the comments being high signal. Doltlight is a fork of SQLite that adds Git-style version control, branching, merging, diffing, and commit history for database state. SQLite is already remarkable software. It's likely the most widely deployed database engine in existence, running in every smartphone, browser, and embedded system. Giving it version control semantics opens up workflows that were previously very cumbersome.
The specific detail that's generating discussion is that DoltHub built Doltlight using approximately 2,000 AI-generated pull requests. They're being transparent about the methodology. The blog post describes using AI coding agents to handle the grunt work of porting the DoltDB version control layer onto SQLite's architecture, with human review at critical junctures. The HN community is treating this as a real-world data point on agent-assisted software development at scale, not just a publicity stunt.
The comments are appropriately skeptical in places. Questions about what 2K agent PRs actually means in terms of code quality, test coverage, and whether the PR count is a meaningful metric at all. But the project is real and in beta, and the people who have actually tested it report that the core functionality works. The branching and merging semantics translate surprisingly cleanly to tabular data, which makes sense. It's essentially what Dolt, the full database product, has been doing for years.
Raven OS deserves a mention here, because it's the kind of project that surfaces a real tension in the open source community between ambition and achievability. Raven OS is an attempt to build an operating system that achieves binary compatibility with Mac OS applications, running Mac OS software on non-Apple hardware, using Darwin, FreeBSD, and Apple's own open source components as the foundation. It's in pre-alpha, which is an honest characterization. The HN thread has 115 comments, and the discussion is genuinely split between people who think this is a legitimate long-term project and people who have watched similar efforts stall in the past.
The historical comparison that keeps coming up is the Hackintosh community, which for years maintained Mac OS compatibility through hardware-level compatibility shims. Apple's transition to Apple Silicon effectively ended mainstream Hackintosh viability because the hardware compatibility assumptions no longer hold. Raven OS is trying to solve the problem at the operating system level rather than the hardware level, which is a different architectural bet. Whether it's achievable depends heavily on how much of Mac OS's behavior is documented in Apple's open source releases versus locked in the proprietary components. And the honest answer is that a substantial fraction of what makes Mac OS applications work is in the proprietary layer.